You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hi, this is Michael Silverblatt, and welcome to Bookworm. My guest today is Harriet Dorr, the author most recently of Consider This Senora, published by Harkett Brace. She's the author as well of Stones for Ibarra. And I wanted to begin by asking you something. This book had a very odd effect on me.
Tell me what.
Sue Ames comes to Amapolis, is that?
Amapolis. It means poppies in Spanish.
And she's in recovery from a loss of love. And she imagines a divorce. And she imagines that she'll stay in Amapolis forever. And this book and this place seem designed to turn everyone's expectations around. Another woman who arrives there expecting to stay forever also doesn't. She loses her lover. The woman who at first refuses to answer letters from her lover suddenly rejoins him by the end of the novel. So it seemed almost as if this was the place in which people learn how to have their expectations betrayed.
In a way, I think that's right. Of course, the older woman, Ursula Bowles, the widow Bowles, her expectation was to die in Mexico, and her wish, and she did. I think she had no further expectations than that. However, I believe that during those years that she lived there, perhaps not a complete understanding, but a better understanding was reached between her and her daughter, the one whose lover was betraying her. I think that was an accomplishment. But I hope with Sue Ames that what happened is that in this new place that she so abruptly and without and thoughtlessly fell in love with, that she started to see life around her differently, and her previous life as well, and perhaps herself as well. I hope that people will see the effect of living in a place that I dreamed up, more or less, the effect of places, actually, on the people who live there and the inhabitants of those places whom they never knew before.
But I noticed that in this place you dreamed up, one feels almost warned not to develop too strong an attachment to anything. And so an old woman, a beggar woman who has a goat that she keeps to remind of her of her dead child, the goat goes running and the woman falls to her death over a precipice. By the end of the book, there's a beggar child who has a cart that he's made for a small dog, and the dog is killed. And it seemed as if in this book, you know, although the narrative tone is very elegant and wry, we seem to be warned not to hold things too tightly.
I think you're right about that. I suppose some of that, I suppose I was influenced by living in Mexico for a number of years. I feel that that's a Mexican attitude, conscious or not, or unconscious. I think that detachment and that ability to accept is a very, very strong Mexican characteristic. Not that the feelings aren't there. The despair, the hope, and the laughter and tears, the whole thing. But I think there is a very long view held by people of all sorts of of backgrounds, whether they live in a village or in a city or whatever their profession is, whether they're on farms or in a doctor's office. I think it's a Mexican quality, and it's one of the ones that draws me to Mexico.
Well, I think, actually, although I know that you have complained that people who talk about your age or make much of it are treating you as a freak, I think that the quality that I'm talking about seems to would not have, a young writer would not have been able to have the experience of knowing how many things are subtracted, how many surprises do arrive, and how much the thing you thought would last forever disappears in a single week. And so I wonder whether there are ways in which your writing has been shaped by being an older woman.
I think everything is shaped by everything. I think everyone is this. I won't say it comes close to being my religion, because that isn't a good description of it. But I think everyone is influenced by everything he touches and everything that touches him. I think no one can walk unscathed through a single day. And I think as the years pass, that's another thing that happens to you. You're being touched by something. Your view backwards gets longer and longer, and you only hope that your memory will stay fairly reliable, though it becomes so entwined with imagination that it's very hard to draw a line between them. No harm done, I say, as a writer. I think those two things can be intermixed and be useful to a writer of fiction.
You've mentioned, I forget where, a fondness for the Mexican writer Juan Rulfo.
I loved the Juan Rulfo stories, which I had in a Spanish class when I was picking up credits at Scripps College before I went back to finish my degree at Stanford, and we read these stories in Spanish, and I thought they were perfectly beautiful. The most beautiful, heartbreaking stories I've ever read, I think.
I read his novel, Pedro Páramo, which seemed to me to be extraordinary.
I think he was a wonderful, wonderful writer.
And wrote very little, too, I think, you know.
I only know the stories.
I think other than the stories, there's only this one novel, as I understand it. And I think also Eudora Welty is a favorite of yours.
Well, Eudora Welty is a marvelous writer and a wonderful person. She came to Stanford. Very, very important writers came from time to time to take a class of the advanced fiction workshop and give a reading. And I had lunch with her one day and sat next to her, and you have the most enormous respect for anyone who can do what she did. And she is a wonderful person just to see and to talk to.
What is your favorite of her work?
Of Eudora Welty?
Yes.
I'm going to surprise you, because I'm not going to give you a story. I loved the book she wrote that Harvard University published.
I do, too.
What is the name of it?
One Writer's Beginnings.
Yes, and I think everything in it, I went around and made a few little talks to reading groups and people who asked me to come. I usually quoted from that by Eudora Welty about character, for instance, that every character is the writer, that the writer is in the character, lives through the character. You don't find a character outside just walking up and down the street. You build that character yourself. And, I wish I'd brought one or two of those quotes along. I think she's a wise woman, and I think she's right about the things she says.
One of the reasons I always liked her is that when she would write critical essays,
yeah,
she would like the most amazing variety of things. So she admires, for instance, Isaac Dinesen, but she knew at the same time that Ross McDonald, the California mystery writer, was really a special American writer. She seemed to be able to find quality in odd
you
places.
You mean at the outset?
At the outset,
yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
She really had an extraordinary eye. Had she taught there at Stanford?
No. No, I don't think so, ever. She only came for a weekend. Several interesting people came for weekends. E.L. Doctorow came once for, well, I say weekend. Actually, they were all class and college days. And he had this group of about 15 for a class and read. And I think there were visitors at this class. And there were questions afterwards, and someone in the class asked E.L. Doctorow how his writing practice was. You know, that is apt to be asked, do you have a typewriter, computer, do you write by hand, and, you know, how many hours a day do you go every single day, what do you do? So that question came up, and he said, this was several years ago, he said he went to the typewriter every morning at 9 and sat there. He said his typewriter was against the wall, he said, to avoid distraction, best not look out a window, pushed against the wall. And he said, he gave an example. He said he sat at the typewriter one day for 45 minutes and absolutely nothing came. So finally, he typed the word wall, because that's what he could see. Then he typed the word room. Then he typed the word house. Then he typed 1906. I'm not sure of the date, but I think 1906. Then he wrote ragtime. So, and I think that's absolutely true. I think something like that builds. And I think one thought leads to another, and your imagination picks up then.
Now, the first book, Stones for Ibarra, was written while you were in that process at Stanford.
Well, I started it a little earlier mm-hmm. than that. I went to Scripps first, as I said, to get credits, and had a wonderful writing course there. And some of the stories, two or three that were in the book, finally, I began at Scripps. I may have rewritten them a little. And then I went on with them at Stanford. I seem to just think of Mexico in those days, I suppose from my ancient love affair with the country.
Was it harder to do a book without the workshop environment? Because Consider This Senora is now the product of postgraduate, I guess, activity.
It is. It's a product of workshop environment entirely. And, yes, it's harder. For me, I'm a person of no self-confidence. And I'm never sure if what I think of is right. I know when I like it, and I know when it sounds right. But is it right? And I need reassurance once in a while. At Stanford, where we all had papers in advance of copies of the stories that were to be read and criticized in advance before we got to class, or at least with notations on them. When a paper was turned in to me later and someone wrote, ugh, in the margin, about a phrase, and someone else said, good, Harriet, then I didn't know what to do. I didn't know whether to pay attention to the ugh or the good.
Did John LaRue tell you then at that point? Was that the was he the referee?
Well, he said, don't pay so much. No, he told me, don't be so influenced by what people, what these students write in the margin. But I was. I thought they were all wiser than I. I always think that of everyone.
Now, this is odd, because this must have been said to you, but both books seem to be written by a very wise person. Wisdom seems to be the result of the story, as if in some way the book seems to be the result of a speaker who has a perspective on many things at once. What impressed me, for instance, reading Consider the Signora, I thought at first that it was a novel about people in retirement from love, and that it would examine various stages of lovelessness. And just as I started to think that, it looked also to be a novel about economy, and a novel of cultural variance, and a novel about the difference between men and women. It seemed as if so many thematics that often are singled out nowadays, one at a time for a novel, are at operation simultaneously here. And the result is that the author sounds very discriminating.
Or does it sound scattered to you?
No, it seemed to me...
It doesn't sound scattered.
No, yeah. I'm relieved to be able to reassure you there. No, it didn't sound scattered to me. It sounded, as I say, rounded and kind of wise.
I can't claim that I'm wise. I'm wise. I still do unwise things and chide myself for them. I don't think wisdom comes with years necessarily. I think the more you read and the more you look around and the more aware you are of what's happening around you, you must be a little bit wiser as you go along, or totally blind to what there is out there, because of the more you see people... Well, I was going to say the more you understand them, but that isn't true. The more you see people, the more questions you have about them, I think, is actually. But some of those questions are fascinating.
How did the book... Can you describe how it evolved?
Yes. I wrote the first chapter...
Oh, you're going to be mean to me, eh?
I wrote the first chapter when I was... still at Stanford, when the other book had been taken for publication and I was about to leave. And I was told that I should embark immediately on something else. I think probably the suspicion was that I might give up then and there, never pick up a pen or pencil again. I don't think that was strictly true. But so I did. I wrote the first chapter, or at least the version of the first chapter, which was pretty much as it ended, that chapter. And then space went by, during which I wrote little things, nothing for the book, and wrote letters, answered letters. I don't know how. My time seemed to be so full. And then I went back to it. And I'm a terribly slow writer, and it took a long time to finish the book. And I had a contract at Harcourt Brace, where Kirk Smith is my editor, and he is a very permissive man, I must say, because each time I said, Kirk, I must have another 6 months or something, he always said, okay, why not? But then came last year, and I thought, this is nonsense, has to stop, because... Nobody my age can keep saying another 6 months forever. I mean, it simply won't work. So I decided that then I must pull together all my energies and finish the book, which I more or less did just before Christmas of last year. Then there was quite a lot of rewriting in the spring. But I'm very slow. To do a chapter perfectly, I mean... To have time to think when you're not writing. You see, that's what I have to have. I have to just sit there looking as if I'm idle and let these thoughts and words come. A bathtub is a wonderful place for ideas. I found out, but I don't always take the paper and pencil and have it close enough. And by the time I have a towel around me and have a pencil and paper, sometimes the idea has flown. Frustrating experience.
Did the book... Has it shape around themes or characters?
You mean life, love, death, or characters?
Yeah.
That's hard to say. I think of life, love, death a great deal. The characters came to me little by little. once I had that first chapter written, it did not occur to me, well, you're going to write a book, you don't have to use that chapter, start over. Didn't occur to me. I just took, after a lapse of several years, I just took all those characters and went ahead with them. I don't know whether that shows a lack of energy or lack of imagination or what, but I think I liked them in the first chapter, and I felt I wanted to stay with them.
Well, there's a lovely feeling in the beginning of the book of a community starting to form. Sue meets the rather sinister-seeming Bud.
Bud Loomis.
who turns out really to be rather quite pleasant. You know,
the reason for that is that he was gross and crass and terrible, and as the book went on, I fell slightly in love with him. So he got more pleasant. I thought he was a very funny man, and it was quite a lot of fun to write about him, too. It was fun to write about him and the tax authorities. There's always some bad person, apparently, in what I write. A bad person who is the exact opposite of me, whom I'm very fond of. It was a taxi driver in the Stones for Ibarra, Chuy Santos. Very, very bad man who endangered the lives of his friends to the point where they actually were killed. But there was something so happy about him. He got through his life somehow, and I liked him.
What I loved was that although everyone in the village is thinking that this is going to be the ruination of Alta Gracia when she marries him, he is in fact reverent to her and very devoted, and in fact stays in Mexico.
Yeah.
Where the other characters do not, and has a child. That seems the most rooted.
I think probably everyone said, how could that beautiful girl marry this dreadful man? For one thing, she didn't speak English, and she didn't know how he talked. And she probably taught him a little more Spanish as time went on. For another thing, I think he was totally in love with her. Maybe I didn't make it clear enough, but I don't think some great buried sense of right and wrong caused him to marry her. I think he wanted to. And she was just a wonderful, wonderful person, something beautiful in his life that he'd never had before, I'm sure. And she was something, he was to her a very, very good person, a remarkably good person, you see. She didn't also know anything of backgrounds, probably not at that point, and probably never asked. I can imagine a marriage like that lasting in Mexico.
There seemed to be one person in the book whose life suggests the duplicities of art, and that is the woman who writes the travel book about Mexico.
Oh, it's Fran Bold.
She seems mainly to make up.
Yes, she does. I think so much of her life, always probably, but especially when she grew up and had men, and then had this Paco. I think a great deal of her life was spent in looking for pleasure and for love, of course, desperately for love, and beautiful places and scenes and the proper sites for happy experiences and all that. I think she saw Mexico through a dreamer's eyes, and when she wrote her book, she lost track of reality completely and exaggerated, which often travel books do, perhaps not to this extent.
I think that what I found most, let me describe the book as I read it, and we can then laugh at how far I was from what anything that might have been in your mind. But what I enjoyed was gradually, as these characters arrive in Amopolis, a community forms, And as they do, these houses, some of them plain, some of them well-planned by Sue, and some of them blunt and coarse because Bud is responsible, it was as if angles and perspectives, as I said it before, on death, on love, on marriage, on youthfulness, mortality, form. And a temporary community seems to be built out of those angles. And then suddenly, toward the end of the book, just when we're thinking, ah, these characters are learning things, it's as if a cloth comes to the blackboard and wipes them off. And it's a very amusing and wry, you know, it's as if simultaneously the things you think are built to last, this author has the grace not to insist on.
I think the things you think will last frequently don't, particularly in this situation with this handful of foreigners among the Mexican people. Of course, it's true of the houses, many of which were unoccupied and I think fell apart from lack of care. But my idea was of transitoriness, of people coming somewhere, trying something, working out at least part of it, and then departing. In my mind, I had a picture. I hope I made this clear. In my mind, I had a picture of this particular mesa, this flat place on the hill, which had been occupied by, you might say, interlopers. After their departure, reverted entirely to Mexico, leaving Don Enrique in his rebuilt hacienda and a few other houses owned by Mexican people. In fact, the old hacienda, in a way, had all its own back when the foreigners left the town. Then I also thought that Ursula Bowles died, but of the other two, it seemed reasonable to me that they would not arrange to live their lives in this one place, that eventually, whatever it was, the same energy that brought them there would probably take them away.
I've been speaking to Harriet Dorr, the author most recently of Consider This, Senora, published by Harkett Brace. Thank you for being with me. My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The engineer today is Scott Fritz. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books. To the land of ice and snow in books.
As you ramble through the pages, books will take you through the ages. Back to days of old when knights were bold in books.
Books, books, books. Too.
Books make you laugh and say, books tell you everything. They're your treasure, friends in prose and rhyme.
Now it's book of the mouse, pop,
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.